go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Boland.
Ben, today we're going to talk about, the world's oldest running car.
Yes, and that's an important qualification. Answering the question of what car is currently the world's oldest running car is way easier than say, what is the world's oldest car?
I tell you, I think I passed the world's oldest running car sometimes on the way into work. Thing is beat up so badly, you know, held together with duct tape. It's got, growth on it, looks like algae, you know, broken windows, that kind of stuff, you know, held together with bungee cords.
And hope. And so many coats of primer that you can measure its age like a tree.
It's held together with a lot of hope. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, it may indeed be one of the world's oldest running cars bedeviling you on the interstate, but the official world's oldest running car is a car that a lot of people may not have ever heard of.
Yeah. It's a strange make and model. Obviously, it's a, I don't know, I guess I want to say kind of an eccentric model, really, because it's a steam-powered car.
Yes, it's a steam-powered car, and it's from the era way before, cast your memory back, just like the Van Morrison song, to an age before Henry Ford, to an age before anything resembling regulation of cars, anything resembling the commonalities that we have. Like, Scott, this bad boy, this little steam car doesn't even have a steering wheel, does it?
No, it doesn't. It has one of those rudder-type configurations for it. And I just think it's such an odd-looking vehicle. I mean, I guess we should just tell people what it is so they can look it up, right?
Oh, yes.
This goes way, 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 way back to, probably coexisting around the time when internal combustion was just then being formulated, when the idea was brand new.
Absolutely.
But they were already building steam cars, of course, because we've talked about that before, that steam cars are around a long time before that. This one goes back to 1884, and it's a model called the De Dion Bouton Trepardeau. And I hope I got that right exactly. But
Dos Steam Runabout is the full name that you'll see sometimes is 1884. De Dion Bouton El Trepardeau Dos a Dos Steam Runabout.
Very good, Ben.
I think you did an excellent job with the French.
we'll maybe shorten that to the De Dion Bouton or something like that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Or the Trepardeau. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But, again, steam-powered car, fueled by wood, by coal, by paper, anything that'll burn, really.
Yeah.
And it had this big hopper in the front. It looks like it almost looks like a steampunk invention, doesn't it?
It really does. This would not be out of place at Dragon Con or another fan convention or even in a sci-fi movie. The car does seat four people. It is open air, and these four people are sitting back to back, two facing forward, two facing reverse.
Ah, yes. And you know what? I'm glad you said that thing about the seats four and all that, because there were other cars. There's another car that is creating a little bit of controversy around this thing.
Right.
And I don't know if you're saving this until later or not, but I think it's important to note that this is this kind of has a little bit of a resemblance to the modern automobile in that it does have four seats. You don't have to have a person that that mans the boiler or anything like that. And that's one of the things that this other car, this other controversial vehicle, there's a car from 1875, which, of course, predates this one, that the British it's a British car that's housed at the National Motor Museum of Britain, and that claims to be the world's oldest car. However, it has only three wheels, so that's one of those three-wheel motorcycle workaround things, although I don't think that pertained at the time. It's just a three-wheel design.
Yeah.
And but it does require an attendant for the boiler at all times, and it doesn't really have any kind of resemblance to the modern automobile. However, this De Dion that we're talking about does have a certain resemblance to the early automobiles. I mean, the four-wheel, four-seat vehicles that, you know, people sat in a standard position. It wasn't anything really unusual, like pulled on a trailer behind it or anything like that.
Right.
No, it doesn't look like a wagon or anything like that. But it looks like you could imagine it being an early automobile.
Yes, that's the thing. You can imagine the skeleton of the future automobiles of the world being in the De Dion. The problem with a three-wheeled vehicle, again, is that it's, I guess the main objection is which of these comes closest, right, to predating the modern car. And we have to, we have to be careful with that distinction because they are, again, they are both steam powered. There is a difference, of course, in the type of steam technology they use, but that's why we have gone with our qualification, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah.
The oldest running car.
Yeah, exactly. And it does, in fact, run. It runs very well. I mean, this thing has a top speed, Ben, mm-hmm. of about 38 miles per hour, which was completely unexpected.
Right.
I didn't think that this thing would move much faster than, you know, just a crawl. Uh-huh. You know, I thought it would be really, really slow. But in 1884, I mean, that's really, really fast for 38 miles per hour. Now, again, four wheels, four seats. So the crazy thing about this car, it was discovered somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where it was discovered, but it wasn't running for decades.
Right.
Prior to, this auction that we're going to talk about in just a moment. All the brass had been removed and melted down to help with, the World War I effort. World War I, I said,
mm-hmm.
Which is strange. So pre-World War I, or since before World War I, this thing wasn't even operating. All the brass fittings for all the steam, mechanisms, you know, all the piping and all everything,
yep.
all the fittings, everything was gone. So somebody had to take the original plans and rebuild the thing after decades of this thing just sitting around, probably in a barn, maybe in a basement somewhere. It was protected because the rest of the body lived. I don't know how well it survived. I mean, I didn't see it pre-restoration, but post-restoration, it's right back to the way it looked.
Right. So maybe some people might say that we should add another caveat, world's oldest restored running car.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
But, I think that we can't be accused of doing too much of an injustice. One note there for that, top speed, that's around 60 kilometers an hour for our friends on the metric system. And at the time, this is just a side note. Mm-hmm. At the time, you read about, Europe's first motoring competition.
I did. You know what? That may very well be the first automobile race in the entire world, really.
Yeah.
There's some controversy about that, of course, because who's going to say this is the first of anything? But
right.
It also goes back almost to the date of the car itself, right?
Mm-hmm. The actual date was 1887. The Dion was the sole entrant.
Well, you know, okay, I can tell you why this is. Other people that had a car like this just didn't bother to show up. Maybe
yep.
they couldn't show up because the thing didn't run. There could be a variety of reasons why the other participants didn't make it, but they expected to have more than just one entrance. So it was supposed to be a race, but it wasn't really a race. It ended up just being kind of a ceremonial run for this De Dion, right?
Like a demo, exhibition.
Exactly, and it was pretty short. I think it was like 1.2 miles, right?
Yes.
It was a very short race, and one of the founders of the company we're going to talk about the car company itself.
Mm-hmm.
We want to talk about the auction first, then the car company. But one of the founders, George Bouton, was the driver of this thing, and I mean, how strange for him to show up, you know, to this race and be the only one to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of make a ceremonial pass. Of course, that's great advertising, you know, promotion.
Yeah. Can't beat that.
Fantastic promotion because, you know, one entrant, lots of spectators. Everybody's going to know the name. And it's going to be, you know, reported in the papers as being, you know, the victor on this day. So good for him. I mean, it was a boon for the company.
Yeah, absolutely. And another note here, the first official land speed record was set in 1898, and it wasn't that far. It wasn't that much faster. It was, what did we say, 37, 38 miles per hour?
38 is the top speed.
38 for the De Dion, and that's in 1887-ish. 1898, the world land speed record becomes 39 and like a little bit over 39 miles per hour.
No kidding.
So not much of a difference.
Wow. Wow, so that was screaming fast in that day, right?
Yes.
Hey, let's talk about the auction because this is where this whole thing comes into play is because no one had really even heard about this car until this point. You know, there was probably some speculation that there was the oldest car sitting in some museum somewhere, but no one had really tracked down what that was. And then mm-hmm. finally, you know, there's this auction that happens in
Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, in 2011. So it's a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing rolls across the block and it does just about twice as well as they expected it to dollar-wise in this auction.
Right. Originally, they thought it would be around $500,000 starting bid, but then it ends up being sold for
$4.6 million. $4.6 million for this car. And I mean, you look at it, it's just an iron block. Really with, I mean, it's beautiful. It really is. I mean, I like it. I think it's cool. But, I don't know, $4.6 million for that thing, Ben? I don't know. I'm struggling with it. In a way, I see it's worth it as a museum piece. In another way,
yeah,
that's $4.6 million. But they did expect it. You said the starting bid was $500,000. That's a lot of money to begin with. I think they expected it to get just over $2 million on auction block, but the bidding just took off when it went across the stage.
Yeah.
So they were exceptionally pleased. I think RM Auctions was the auction house that did this in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So this thing is 127 years old at the auction point. Now it's 129 this year. That's the highest price ever paid for an early automobile at auction, by the way. Mm-hmm. And whoever bought this thing, their name hasn't been made public. So I don't know if that's changed since then, like if it showed up in someone's collection. I'm sure that someone knows where that thing is right now.
Yeah, but it's not public knowledge at this point. I think maybe if you dig in deep to some forums, you might be able to find the private collector himself maybe bragging, or one of his buddies.
You know, I would think after 2 years that someone knows where that thing is. So
surely.
I mean, it's got to be out there. I didn't dig deep enough, I'll tell you, to find out where it is or where it exists.
Mm-hmm. And we should go ahead and note that once this hit the net and once this hit the airwaves, people wanted to know so much more about this car. And in our look at the car itself, we found a fascinating story about a little auto company called De Dion.
Yeah, you know what, though? I think that maybe before we do that,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about something just a little bit different. I know we've been getting back into our movie club thing,
yeah.
Right?
Can you tell?
I'm excited about today's pick because you've pre-warned me about what you're going to mention today.
Yeah.
And I like it.
Oh, good. That's great, because I am unreasonably excited about this. Ladies and gentlemen, now Scott and I can finally talk about one of our favorite movies.
Yeah, it's got to be up there.
It's up there.
Mm-hmm.
That is Ghostbusters, the original 1984 supernatural meets science fiction adventure for the ages. Yeah, I said it. Ghostbusters is out on Netflix now, and why are we talking about this on a car show, Scott?
Should I just say it? Because
just say it.
Ecto-1, and I know that everybody else is all excited about this too. If they've seen the movie, they know about it, because Ecto-1 was such a cool car. It was the Ghostbusters car.
Yeah.
And it was this really cool ambulance that was an old Cadillac, right?
Mm-hmm.
Early 60s Cadillac. I don't know what year specifically. Early 60s. Well, I think it was made by the Miller Meteor Company, mm-hmm. who is that specialty car maker who makes hearses and ambulances. Fantastic car, but they made it look really cool with a lot of add-on things, kind of like, you know, the DeLorean in Back to the Future.
Absolutely. Good comparison. Yeah, it's got sirens on the top. It's got some vaguely scientific equipment. It also holds the proton packs and the traps for ghosts. The Ecto-1... In case for some reason you haven't seen Ghostbusters, I'm sorry. This is your chance. You will feel so much better. The Ecto-1 is not necessarily one of the stars of the show, but when the Ghostbusters really start busting ghosts and things are really kicked up a notch and the story just takes off, then the Ecto-1 becomes like the fifth member of the team.
Yeah, they're driving it all over New York City.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing you see when they pull up to a building, you know, that's supposedly haunted, you know, has all these creatures inside that are there to excise, I guess, to remove from the building. Is that the right term? I guess, what do they do with them? They suck them into that wand thing that they had. It was such a cool movie.
Uh-huh.
Neat idea.
They sucked them into the trap. They herd them. They kind of lasso them with the proton packs and put them into... Oh, gosh, Ghostbuster fans are going to hate us because I can't remember the name of the equipment, but they put them in the ghost trap.
Sure.
And every kid in the 80s had probably some version of this toy. And then they feed them into this giant repository that holds all these captured ghosts. Just so you guys know, this is not necessarily a spoiler because we're not telling you how it ends. But the bad guys in this film are the EPA, which I thought was an interesting choice. I'm pretty sure they're the EPA, right?
I'm pretty sure that a lot of our listeners will agree.
But
so Ecto-1 is so cool. If you get a chance to see this movie, I'll say that Ecto-1 is one of the stars of the
Definitely.
Film.
Definitely. Ecto-1 is the fifth Ghostbuster. Now, if you've never seen the film, or if you want to watch it with your kids for the first time, Yeah, some of the special effects could be a little dated, but the Ecto-1 in this day and age, Scott, still looks amazing.
Yeah, the Dédéon Bouton, which, you know, is really a combination of, well, three, well, you know, the first car, I guess, the Dédéon Bouton Trépardeau, is the combination of the three founders of the company. All three of them got their names on this first vehicle. And I find that kind of interesting because the company was founded in 1883. And it lasted for a long, long time. It lasted until 1932. So it just, I mean, after World War One, just prior to World War Two, but these founders, I guess, Jules Albert Dédéon and George Bouton and Charles Trépardeau were the three founders of the company.
Yes. And, interesting story about the way they meet. Jules himself is from a very wealthy, very old family. He is an aristocrat, a marquis, I think. And he is walking by, so the story goes, correct me if I'm wrong here, Scott, he's walking by a toy shop.
Yeah, a scientific toy shop.
Which
is pretty cool.
Like the, it's kind of like the 19th century version of the Discovery Store or
something. Yeah, and this is in 1881. So he's walking by this toy shop, and what does he see in the window?
He sees a little steam locomotive.
Yeah, just a toy steam locomotive that's sitting there that supposedly these guys had built or had created, made.
Yeah.
And the owners of the company were George Bouton and Charles Trépardeau.
Yeah, and Trépardeau was Bouton's brother-in-law, and at the time, things weren't going that well for them. They were poor as sin. They were broke as a joke without a punchline, and they were trying to make a living selling these scientific toys. So the thing that turns out, though, that a lot of people didn't know is that they also had a dream of building a large steam-powered vehicle.
Yeah, because, you know, there are other steam vehicles around at the time. I think, I want to say Stanley was probably around at the time. I didn't check the dates on the Stanley
the
company.
Stanley,
yeah, like the Stanley steam cars, of course. Yeah, I would guess they're right around this time. I'll have to check the dates on it. But, anyways, Dédéon, he wanted to buy another version of this toy steam locomotive. He said, you know, I'd like you to make another copy of that for me. And they said, that's fine. And, you know, they've all three got this kind of early interest in steam power. They're all intrigued by or inspired by steam, as some people like to say.
Yeah.
And of course, with no money, Bouton and Trépardeau say that, well, you know, with this Dédéon guy's money, with his backing, we might be able to make this work because all three of us have similar interests. So let's all get together. Let's form a, you know, we have the know-how. You have the money. Let's get together and build that car that we're talking about. And so they did that in, well, they founded a company in 1883 to do so. And they started building these steam cars with an unsuccessful attempt. The first car burned right to the ground.
Yeah, destroyed by fire, in 1883.
Which won't surprise you when you look at the first Dédéon, Bouton that we're talking about.
For
here.
Sure. They are flammable.
Yeah, they're very flammable. And, you know, I mean, I've watched other steam cars being operated, and I can completely understand how a steam car would burn right to the ground. I get it.
Yeah.
So, the first attempt, unsuccessful. Second attempt, wildly successful. They had a car that actually worked. It ran. Everything was just right about it.
Yeah. The boiler and the engine were mounted at the front. It was steering with the rear and the rear wheel were steering. The front wheels were powered by belts. That's the one that burned to the ground, right? The next one had more conventional steering and it had rear wheel drive. Wow, I almost had my rural juror moment. Rear wheel drive.
It's a tough one to say. It's a tough one to say. So there's and this is kind of crazy, Ben. In the late 1880s, these guys were actually, for a short time, the world's largest automobile manufacturers.
I'm so glad you said that.
It started like really slowly. I mean, with this unsuccessful attempt, and then, you know, this car that we're talking about, the Bouton Trépardeau, and soon afterwards, these guys are building cars faster than anybody else. Now, again, late 1880s, I wonder how many cars that really means.
Right. Is there a trick in the statistics there? They were offering what are called steam tricycles.
Mm-hmm.
So these things were three-wheeled vehicles. These are not your children's tricycles, is what we're saying. They're tricycles for grown-ups. They are steam-powered. They're pretty darn close to cars. They can be joined by a tractor. They can pull trailers.
I saw a few photos of them pulling a trailer, mm-hmm. and this is kind of ridiculous. I mean, there's a grown man riding on a tricycle, which looks like a tricycle, really. It's a big, huge tricycle with great big wheels and everything.
Yeah.
Really, a kind of a neat vehicle. But then it's pulling this ridiculous-looking trailer behind it with some guy in a suit, you know, in a bowler cap,
yeah.
And looking very stern with his big, you know, bushy mustache and everything, and a cigar probably. It looks ridiculous. A grown-up pulling a grown-up on a tricycle in a cart. It looks
yeah.
like a kid's toy, but. You know, honestly, it's a cool vehicle for the time because mobility just wasn't what it is now, of course. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is kind of one of the only options, and it was a good option. Steam power was something that people were really buying into at the time. They were saying, this is it. This is the way of the future.
Right. And it's interesting when we look back in history and we wonder how far steam power could have gone. Was it always destined to be sort of the laser disc of locomotion? But the what's interesting here is that eventually, around 1894, their internal tensions began to arise in the auto company because everybody except for two of the guys, Bouton and De Dion himself, were convinced that internal combustion, not steam power, would be the way to go.
Yeah, and Trappardot, he didn't agree with that. So in, 1894, as soon as they kind of branched out into the internal combustion engine world, I guess, he strongly supported steam power, of course. So he said, you know what, I'm out. I'm done.
Yep.
And he walked away from the company. So then it's just De Dion and Bouton. And that's where we have the Dion Bouton company that we're talking about from, again, 1883 to 1932.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple things that I want to mention. They were racing steam cars in the 1890s, so
yeah.
They were already kind of on that bandwagon.
Oh, when they didn't get disqualified.
That's... Yeah, and why is that?
They were disqualified, I believe, in one 1894 race, the Paris-Rhône race, because their vehicle needed both a driver and a stoker. So it needed someone to stoke the flames for the boiler.
Oh, okay. And they didn't really even need that. They didn't require it, right?
This was a larger vehicle that was introduced at a different time. So they were making vehicles. They were racing. But they were, you know, it's one of the problems of being a pioneer, man.
I guess so. You got to read that.
Keeps you down.
Got to read that rule book carefully before you go to the races, right?
Right.
All right. So they also made steam buses and trucks,
yep.
and they
yep.
did. They actually made steam buses and trucks all the way until 1904, which I found surprising because you know they're already playing around with internal combustion in 1894. So that's a decade later that they're still building these steam vehicles. You know what? I'm going to step back in time just a moment because in 1889, now this company, they're fantastic engine builders apparently, because in 1889, the company built a 2-row, 10-cylinder rotary engine, which is kind of like the radial configuration that you see on the front of, like the old airplanes. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's the kind of rotary that we're talking about, not like the Mazda rotary engine, but,
right.
You know, not the Wankel rotary, I mean. This is like the radial configuration you'd see on old airplanes with the cylinders kind of in a sun pattern. So they made a 2-row, 10-cylinder rotary engine all the way back in 1889 that operated. And, again, you mentioned the tricycles already.
Mm-hmm.
They also made tri-cars, which were the three-wheel cars, of course, and they made four-wheelers, of course. And they also started supplying engines to other manufacturers.
Yeah, they had licensed it to more than 100 manufacturers. You'll see numbers that vary. One of the common accepted ones is 150 manufacturers. But these predecessors of motorcycles, known as moto bicycles, mm-hmm. Loved De Dion Bouton engines because I know this sounds weird in our modern day, it produced about 1.3 horsepower.
That sounds all right.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound too bad.
And it was copied, or at least De Dion's advocates claim, their engine design was copied by people around the world, including motorcycle makers like Harley Davidson and Indian.
Oh boy, those are fighting words, Ben.
Those are fighting words.
Yeah, you're saying Harley Davidson copied a French company, Ben.
I'm not. I'm saying that people who are fans of the Dion say that. Please,
I understand.
Please, Hell's Angels.
I know. I'm trying to get you in a little bit of trouble. But listen, by 1900, they were producing 400 cars a year and 3,200 engines per year. So they were shipping these other 2,800 engines to other companies to put in their vehicles or on their motorbikes or whatever they were doing with them. And by 1904, Ben, they were producing 40,000, or they had built 40,000 engines at that point.
Now, also, we need to keep in mind that at this point, we still haven't had the revolution of the assembly line. So all of these engines are handmade, as well as the cars. But to me, the engines are more impressive.
Get this. 1910, the first company to build a successful V8 engine was De Dion Bouton. So I would never have expected that De Dion Bouton was the first successful V8 engine manufacturer. I wouldn't have ever put the two together.
Yeah.
And they also made, this is where this World War One thing comes in. World War One thing. It sounds funny when I say it like that, but how we talked often about how automobile manufacturers and, anybody who was in the blacksmith profession, anybody who, was machining anything.
Even farriers.
Anything. Anybody that would stamp steel. Or iron or whatever. I mean, they were creating things for the war effort. And that's true for World War One, World War Two, all the wars. They were building aircraft engines. They were building armored vehicles. They were building gun parts.
Yep.
And later they supplied the French army with anti-aircraft guns that were mounted on V8 powered De Dion Bouton trucks. And those were all built between 1913 and 1918. That sounds like a cool vehicle.
Yeah, which is a massive undertaking. And, you know, this is familiar, but it's still always going to fascinate me, Scott, that the power that an industry can have when it throws itself entirely into a single effort, you know?
Yeah, it completely switches over. I mean, we're doing something strictly for our own profit and our own pleasure, really. I mean,
sure.
For, the masses, I guess.
Well, let's keep in mind, to be candid, for much of the beginning years, these automobiles were a rich boy's toys.
Definitely, yeah. They were something that you didn't have to have a car really, because you could have a horse and buggy or a wagon that they could pull, or you could just ride a horse into town, and tie it up there at the at the stall at the post. But to drive a car into town, that was something else. I mean, you'd arrived at that point, right? I mean, in the early 1880s.
Frightening the local townsfolk.
Yeah, really. I mean, I know it sounds funny, but some towns, some villages, cities, they didn't get to see automobiles until, 1910 or something like that. You know, they just weren't around if they were remote enough.
I feel sorry for the horses. Wouldn't that scare the hell out of you?
I think it would. And, it still does. Horses are freaked out by this in cities now, where they're pulling, horse carriages on, the tourists that go through the cities and things.
Yeah.
Horses are still scared of cars. So I can imagine back then, they were loud. They were noisy. They were kind of something completely out of the ordinary. I had never seen one.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be quite a shock. I'm getting way off on a
point. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Speaking of shocks, let's go to after World War One.
Yeah, sure. So after World War One, they continued to build these cars and trucks and things like that. But they also branched out into rail cars. In the 1920s, they were building rail cars, and I think they kind of lasted about a decade or so, and then they gave that up just before the company ended as well, like the early 1930s.
Yeah, the thing is that after World War One, they were still producing a lot of their typical consumer fare. So they were still making V8 engines. They came out with some different types of models, a type LA and a type LB, the primary difference being in the engine used. And the problem was that these were expensive, and sales were sluggish. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, especially after the destruction that happened in the market, were busy repairing their quality of life and couldn't afford a new expensive toy like a car. There was, for a time, there was an idea that they were going to be taken over by another car company, one or the other, but nothing came of it.
Yeah, I think the two that they mentioned were Mercedes or Peugeot, but that never happened.
Yeah, and so they still They ended, as you said, production of their passenger cars in 1932, but sales kept dwindling. And then this is interesting. I wanted to ask you about this, Scott. The ultimate end of the DiDio name.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know that there are some questions there. We know that even if you go as recently as the 1950s, Land Rovers had the badge.
Yeah. So this is like 20, 23 years later that suddenly the DiDio name pops up again. And this is kind of weird because they built some commercial vehicles, around 1950 with DiDio DiDion badge on them. And I would guess DiDion engine. I think that's what's going on. But they actually built a few of these DiDion badged Land Rovers in early 1950s, and that was it. There were just a few of these things hanging around, and then that was kind of the last anybody heard of the company until the mid 1950s, about 1955, when a motorcycle manufacturer bought the company's name. And really, that's about it. I mean, that's the end of the name. So, you know, the whole legacy of this company, I mean, I don't know how long that is, from 83 to 32,
mm-hmm.
Just about 50 years, right?
Yeah.
51 years, something like that, 49. It's, I mean, mostly I guess this company would be remembered as an engine company.
Yeah, I would agree with that because that would be, if you look at just their output, that's the bulk of their contribution.
Mm-hmm.
However, we do also have to say that they did have a widespread reputation for durability and consistency. And I like to think that if the three founders were alive today, they would be pretty happy with knowing that they created the world's oldest running car.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, for that thing to hang on this long, I mean, that's a true test of the product's durability, its reliability. Mm. I mean, to last this long, 129 years, that's amazing. I know someone's, you know, babying this thing and taking care of it, and I got that. But, you know, that could happen with any car, really.
Yeah.
But for this one to last that long, that's something special, because a lot of these just ended up in really just a rust heap, you know, in someone's garage somewhere.
Sure, or a war scrap field.
Yeah, I can't believe the whole thing wasn't scrapped for the war, just the brass. That was very lucky on the part of, you know, whoever found this thing, that they found a nearly complete vehicle and that they could find the original plans to go back and rebuild this thing. And to create something that's worth, you know, $4.6 million at auction, that's pretty amazing.
Oh, I do have a rumor for us to end this on.
Oh, great.
I don't have the identity of the owner, but the rumor has it that private collector lives in Texas.
Really?
And is taking very, very good care of this, I'll go ahead and say it, this museum piece.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a little like Indiana Jones. Do you remember that scene in Indiana Jones? I think it's, the third one, the Search for the Holy Grail one, mm-hmm. where he's yelling, "It belongs in a museum."
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah, but he is taking care of it.
Yeah, I understand that. And I would bet that this thing shows up at a concourse event sometime.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's going to make it across the stage for the judging and all
Pebble
that.
Pebble Beach or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to show up here or there. I'm sure that shows, you know, these early automobile shows are dying to get this thing to appear.
Oh, my gosh. Can you imagine seeing it in person?
It's kind of the crown jewel of, you know, the early automobile.
Okay, we'll end this on that high note. Scott, you and I are heading off to work on our next episodes and our brand new website, carstuffshow.com.
Yeah, that's right. There's blog posts there. You can check out the podcast, of course. Mm-hmm. All of our podcasts are there, the entire library of them.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. I mean, I know iTunes is good, but I think you can only get, what is it, 200 episodes?
iTunes will cut you off after the most recent 300. And
okay.
We have more than 300 shows now.
Absolutely do have more than that. We've been doing this for many years now. So there's that. There's, like I said, there's blog posts. There's videos there.
Yep.
You can link to our Facebook from that, our Twitter feed. All kinds of stuff.
And on our Twitter and our Facebook, you can drop us lines directly if you would like to suggest something new for us to cover in the future, or if you would like to show us some pictures of your car, which we are always big fans of. Or heck, if you want to cut out the social media, you can send us an email directly. We are
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.